Up next, host Sheila Setharaman interviews 2012 Tech Award winner Arup Sengupta, professor of civil and environmental engineering and chemical engineering at Lehigh University. Sengupta explains his project to eliminate poisonous arsenic in groundwater without using electricity or chemicals, transforming the arsenic crisis into an economic enterprise.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to bring you another presentation in the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems.
And now, here is our presentation.
Hello, this is your host Sheila Setharaman, and we are delighted to have with us Mr. Arup Sengupta, Professor of Civil Environmental Engineering and Chemical Engineering at Lehigh University. He is one of the recipients of the Tech Award for 2012 in the environment category. And we are delighted that he is here to talk about his project, which is doing some very innovative work to eliminate and prevent contamination in groundwater. And so we'll hear from him about the project and the successes and the future. Welcome, Mr. Sengupta, and it's a pleasure to have you on the call.
Thank you.
So tell us about your project. My understanding is that you have been doing research for a number of years to really study arsenic contamination in groundwater and came up with some really innovative and revolutionary ways to separate out the arsenic. So talk to us about this work.
I work in a university, so I've been doing research in water area, primarily in the area, I would say, we call it trace contaminants removal. So in 1995, I first was confronted with this problem in other parts of the world, primarily in South and Southeast Asia. And there I found kind of a logical extension of what we are already doing in all kinds of trace contaminants. And arsenic kind of surfaced as a major crisis. And the one thing made the problem overly complicated or difficult to resolve, because most of the people who are affected by the crisis, they live in the remote rural areas. And most of them also make less than $2 a day, probably. So this was like, how do you take or kind of deliver a technology, develop it, and then transfer it to a remote place. So we went through a process of evolution. But finally, you know, after, as it happens with any kind of research and development, we went through many iterations. We extended our alliance with local regional universities, NGOs in India, in Cambodia, and in Argentina, and now also in Nepal. In Bangladesh, we're also trying to do something. And this is, arsenic is not a unique thing in those places per se. It's also a significant problem in the United States. So we finally came up with a material which is very sturdy. It's very arsenic selective. That means it can take away arsenic without nearly touching anything else. And when you develop that, Lehigh University filed a patent, a company in the United States came forward, they formed what you call a license agreement, and now they have been manufacturing, maybe have manufactured more than 2 million pounds of the material. But again, still it is made only in the United States. And we have been using this material along with a few others, you know, in different parts of the world. It has certain advantages. You know, the cost goes down. It's very robust. Once they have it, they do not have to rely on anything else. And the local economy can grow. We call it now The title of the project for Tech Award was Transforming Arsenic Crisis into an Economic Opportunity. So it is not just the development of the material. This is about how did we use this material by integrating, you know, the people in remote villages so that they themselves can run it, keep running it. And in many places, it has been running for nearly 10 years, and they collect a tiny amount of tariff. With that money, they have grown economically. Some people are employed. In other words, there has to be an kind of concomitant or accompanying economic growth. Otherwise, it's very difficult to sustain. And quality control is also important. So that's how it has progressed, you know. Yes, there is a research component, development component, taking the product into the marketplace, getting all the stakeholders like villagers and the local peoples, authorities, the NGOs and universities there. So it's very much of an international activity now. I hope I have given you a broad outline of the whole project.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's extremely helpful. And some of the best projects or the most successful ones are those where you can really come across from multiple perspectives, not just build the technology, but engage the local communities as well, which looks like you have done very successfully. Talk to us more about the materials and the product itself. So you created these materials, and then what? How does it actually purify the water?
Yeah, the way it purifies, I mean, it is, first of all, it is highly scalable. You know, you can put it in a tiny Brita filter, that's possible. And it has been done in some places. And that means what you call household or domestic use. And at the same time, at the other end, this material is in use, say, in some of the very large arsenic removal plants in the United States and also in Europe, you know, like where the capacity may be for 50,000 people or even more, you know. The way it works is that this is very much like a tiny beads, polymer beads. And this nanotechnology in a way played a role because we took the polymer beads, we call it ion exchange resins, you know, from the market. So it's available everywhere around the world, and found a way to disperse, you know, some nanoparticle of iron oxide, which is also very innocuous. And these two together, that's the synergy, you know. I mean, we needed both. Polymer was needed to impart strength, durability, good hydraulic property, whereas this nanoparticle of iron oxide provided a very high arsenic removal capacity. So these two together played the role. And once it is made, you know, it is innocuous. It can be transported. It can also be manufactured very easily in other parts of the world. But it has not happened. There is a reason there. Some kind of company and our license agreement thing. But it can also be made in other places. So that's how the material is, basically. And this material can be reused, you know, after. This is a very important attribute of the material, that once its capacity to remove arsenic has been all exhausted, then after adopting a simple chemical process, arsenic can be stripped off and the material can be reused many, many other cycles. In other words, in remote areas, once that practice is in use and they have a supply of material, they can use it, and they have been doing that maybe for 10 years in some places. So that's a kind of a key component which sets it apart from other materials which have been available. They have good properties, but they're not reusable. They are not sturdy as the ones, you know, we have. And like any research, you know, we did it originally for arsenic, but now we find out it can do many other things. So It is being used in some places for removing phosphorus, which is also environmentally significant. And very recently, people are trying it in the last 1 year to remove radioactive contaminants in Fukushima Daiichi, the nuclear power plant in Japan, which was hit by tsunami, and then it kind of broke down and many problems erupted from there. Interestingly enough, we knew it has some properties to remove radionuclides, but that was not the intention. And I'm not directly involved in that, but it was very, very gratifying to find out that they are very actively trying that for large-scale application in Japan, you know, using the same material, you know, because it has some interesting properties.
Very interesting. And thank you for the clarification and the explanation. Especially what's intriguing is that you can use it and reuse it many times around. And that's powerful, I'm sure. So talk to us more about, you did mention that you have been out in the field and engaged the community and really made them own this process. Have you been involved in that, and how has that worked?
Yeah, it you know, that's not my area of specialty. It has evolved with time. I have learned things myself. And last year, 2012, I was in India as a Fulbrighter, the Fulbright Fellowship. This year, I have a doctoral student who is in South Asia, American student, as a Fulbrighter there. He is pursuing the same thing. And in India, maybe there are four different universities I have worked with. In Argentina, hopefully it will grow there. In Cambodia, Institute of Technology in Cambodia, and quite a few NGOs. Because in order to implement technology in a geographic area, anybody, you know, needs to form alliance with some local entities who champion it. First, they have to believe in it, and they will champion the cause and then moving it forward. So we worked with Institute of Science recently, but before that, Bengal Engineering and Science University, and then college in Patna, and some NGOs there, same in Cambodia, and identify villages, try to find villages where the problem is critical, then get the people together with the conception that we'll do something, but then they have to take the ownership of the whole thing, which means they have to learn how to operate it, which is easy to follow. Some people would be there to explain that procedure to them. Then they have to form a committee, including women, you know, who will be responsible for collecting a tariff, which is nominal, but it's necessary to run such systems there. And some people will be employed through those tariffs, so there's a vested interest in running the process. The water quality has to be monitored, tested. It has to be very transparent so that people know what they're drinking. So there are quite a few steps. But at the end, though, the success is if we move away from that, whether they're able to run it or not. And that's what has happened in many places. And in some places, in some villages, people are doing it more economic growth related to a crisis. In other words, it is just not a water problem. This is also an opportunity to thrive and make wealth, you know, if I may use that word, by solving a potential problem, which is arsenic poisoning. And we are doing similarly. We are now aggressively pursuing like arsenic, fluoride in groundwater is also a major issue. In Africa, this is a significant issue, and also in Asia. And then that's also technology we have developed, I may say, but now we are ready for field trials in going both to Africa and India and maybe a few other countries. So that's, I believe, in TechHour, that was also something mentioned, you know, I did not remember. So that's a very, Volume-wise, that's a bigger problem, but fluoride is not as toxic as arsenic. Arsenic is very, very fatal. That's why it draws attention. But fluoride has been around for quite a long time without, to my knowledge, any real technological solution.
And so how do you plan to use the tech monies? What area of the project are you going to spend that on?
That's already earmarked very much. This is about $75,000. I'm an individual. We have a foundation here. The money came to. We have a not-for-profit foundation where many of my students and former students are very much involved, you know. So the money was kind of taken in the name of that foundation. And what we try to do is, we're not going to change the world, but we only undertake problems which doesn't have technological solutions, we believe, as yet. In other words, we do not want to do routine things, you know. After all, we belong to the academia, you know. When a problem or a crisis appears to be seemingly unsolvable or very difficult, arsenic was that, because 25 years ago nobody knew about this thing, and then this problem kind of surfaced. It's still now, you know, it's an unsolved problem. But we sincerely believe we have brought it to a point that any government, any organization can apply it. We have written many papers, many places. People are reading those papers and trying to kind of reconstruct the whole thing. So basically creating the knowledge and then passing it on so that other people can be on their own. So we want to move on. You know, arsenic we're still doing. For fluoride, I want to invest part of that money to run short of a pilot plant in the field, in either in Ethiopia or in Kenya. These are the two places. There are many countries in African continent who... I was in Ethiopia last month or the month before. A lot of people are suffering because technology cannot be implemented just like that, because you have to gain people's confidence, you know, so that they run it, they see how easy it is to run, how does it compare with others. And in every place, people have some preconceived notion, you know, so that's the most difficult part. That's, to me, the most difficult part. It is not the technology. So people are not normally there to welcome, you know, new technology. You know, you have to earn their confidence. In Cambodia, we had the same problem. Maybe in Ethiopia, we may run into that. But that means first we have to believe in ourselves that this process has certain advantages. And that's maybe we'll be spending the money for, that refining our process to the point that it is very robust, that almost impossible to fail. You know, I believe in the developing world, if one is to work, it's very important, as opposed to in the developed world, because you have a backup system if something fails. Over there, if something fails, it just fails. It cannot be salvaged, and people lose confidence in that. So about investing money, you know, fluoride is the one we are, as far as the development of technology is concerned, we are doing. For arsenic, what we are doing is, so far we did community-based system. Now I want to invest some money. Can one or two enterprising person learn about the technology, come forward, implement it, and then on their own they sell water. And in India now, as we speak, you know, today I got an email. This is a lady in an Indian village, college. She at least went to college. I do not know whether she finished her education or not. And we are empowering her. She has formed a company called Aqua Bengal. Same thing is going to happen in Bangladesh. And now, the plant, small plant arsenic removal has been installed. Now, she's the one who is going to move it forward, to market the water, to collect the money. In other words, this is basically a kind of height of entrepreneurship to me, you know, transforming the arsenic crisis into an Proteus in a village far away, whether she can sustain her business there. So we have put some money there, and this is a test case to me, that it doesn't need to be a community. It can be just one or two individuals who will carry the burden to form alliance with the affected people there, sell the water, just like any other business, you know. So that's also another business model where we plan to do things here, and then we are talking to some people in Bangladesh about it. So that's the goal at this time. And, these are all the things are something which I don't know as yet. So if there is any difference between us and many other not-for-profit organizations, we only try to do things for which we believe the answer doesn't exist, you know. People talk a lot. The governments, they also talk a lot, but the problem has not been solved in Cambodia, Vietnam, India, Bangladesh for sure. So that's where we want to spend $75,000. Very slowly, though. I mean, we don't have a huge amount of money. The doctoral student, you know, who is a student in our department, he's as a Fulbrighter now in India, and he has been to Cambodia, going to go to Bangladesh. And he wants to combine, we still don't know how, this science part with this business model into his PhD thesis.
Interesting. Definitely one of the challenges for many nonprofits is to come up with a sustainable and viable business model. And you're definitely looking at that as well. What are some things that you've been thinking about in terms of a scalable business? Do you see yourself sort of sustaining your work and ideas through foundation funding and other such, investments? Or do you look at a more sustainable revenue generation? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, it has to be economically sustainable. Otherwise, it's impossible. Now, the challenge here is that, you know, but this is kind of, we have accepted the challenge because this is a difficult problem, which is we want it to grow economically, but at the same time, we have to deliver the service to the people who need it. You know, that's the part. Now, the people who need the service, they make less than $2 a day. So this is like, I do not want to move away from that. I think we can do it, you know. The student Mike is there. He's trying different models where we'll sell these things to, or many other things, you know, to urban population. And that's there. But there is nothing new in it, you know. A lot of other people are doing it, you know. I mean, that's like sustaining it, making money. But here the element I do not want to forget or back away from is that the people who make less than $2 a day, they need to benefit, but at the same time, we have to make it economically sustainable. Now, there are many models. One of the models he keeps saying, and the student of mine, we should do, and I agree with that. It's called hybrid model. That means sell it to them, also sell it to the people who are more affluent, okay? That probably would evolve with time, you know, and some other small companies have joined us because they want to take advantage of the technologies we have, or we have been planning to develop, or we have already developed, okay? But I don't think I am there, you know, short of as in the lead. And it also, our foundation carries the name of a person, you know, a poet. I am, from your name, it looks like you have Indian connection, right?
Yeah.
Like this is, you know, our national anthem, you know, it's written by Rabindranath Tagore, you know. And the name of the foundation starts with him. I studied him rather closely. And he, to me, also was probably the first social reformer besides being poet, philosopher, and all kinds of things. You know, he started that maybe about 120 years ago, you know, when India was still not an independent country. So this kind of spirit has to be there, the benefit has to reach to the bottom, but it has to be sustained, and that makes it difficult. For that, maybe you will slowly embrace the hybrid model, and mine is not-for-profit. Mike has formed a company, the student of mine, that's for-profit. We call it WISE, you know, Water Innovation in Science and Engineering. Maybe these two kind of coalesce well. So I have nothing against that. But as I told you, you know, that even if the business grows, one of the metrics of success would be decided by how many who didn't have arsenic safe water or fluoride safe water or safe water in general. We also work in the area of sanitation and some of school education now, because right now there are some schools where we are trying to provide safe water. Not arsenic problem, but there are other problems. So that metric would always be there, though. I mean, like, how many more people or students in remote villages are drinking safe water or have access to acceptable sanitation, I mean, along with the economic growth. So that's a key element, you know.
Absolutely. And as a social enterprise, you are always challenged with balancing the making good and doing good at the same time. You definitely have the right approach here, both the long-term vision as well as a near-term strategy. The other thing I think that's really critical is that you are looking at diversification, not just at arsenic, but at other opportunities. And what's really intriguing is where you say you like to tackle challenges that for which there are no answers, no known answers anyways. So it's that kind of innovation that I think we need more of. And it's such a pleasure to have been talking to you, learning about your work, and we wish you all success and good luck in this and in your future endeavors.
Thank you very much for talking to us, and all the best to you.
Thank you again, Mr. Sengupta.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems.
To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nee on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.